system or families. That's about Chris. Chris obviously has some problems. I've never met him. But they got him into our housing and got him back into school, graduated from high school, and accepted to Hamline University. That's a powerful thing when you hear that in my position. Now, they also told me he was considering whether he was going to go to Hamline or the Army. And I hope he goes to Hamline, but truthfully, either one is a tremendous success story for Chris. Because he now has something to look forward to. He has a place in the world. And it's that, for that reason, we ought to be making sure that we have enough housing for the folks in our community. Enough homes for the folks in our communities. Central Community Housing Trust is expanding. We used to be just in Minneapolis in the last 3 or 4 years. We're expanding. We're doing a project in Chaska. We're working with the city of Roseville. We've just completed a building that was vacant for 30 years in downtown St. Paul in Lordtown. As a matter of fact, it's not too far from here. If you ever want a tour, just give me a call. We're happy to do a tour. Just did one this morning at 7:30, as a matter of fact. It's a great place, serving 56 minimum wage earners, basically, in downtown St. Paul. It's only a few blocks from here, really, and 14 homeless people also are living in that building. It's 100% occupied right now. One of the things to understand as you, the committee and the legislature does its work is that creating new affordable housing is important and should be a part of our goals, but also preserving the existing affordable housing is an important piece. It doesn't do us much good to just create if we're losing affordable housing in the back end. So just understanding that piece is really important. There are a number of really great ideas about how we fund additional affordable housing and how we change policy, and I'm not going to get into that. There's other people I'm sure will be talking to you over the course of time about exact policies and proposals that are in front of you. I would just say that anything that helps is important, and certainly at Central Community Housing Trust we support that. Again, I'd like to invite you to see any of our housing at any time. We feel like our housing is always the best homes on the block, and that we're always proud to show it to folks. We've won tons of awards, but it's not the awards. It's about being a responsible neighbor in our communities. With that, maybe I'll just stop and see if there are any questions about how the affordable housing world works, how this stuff gets done or built, how our organization works, or anything else in the housing world that I can answer. So. Madam Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you. I just want to thank you, Mr. Arthur, for your leadership in the arena. I know in my district I have some of this housing, and it's been a lot. And I hope some of the rest of you, if you do have a chance, you mentioned the idea of a tour, and I saw a couple heads shaking, so maybe we'll get a chance to look at that. Representative Peterson.
Thank you. Alan, how do you take, for instance, Chaska, how did you start that? What was the beginning of that, the genesis of that project, and how does it go?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, one of the interesting things that we just realized that shows you what adult I am sometimes, 5 years ago, I don't think many people know about us, we said. It didn't seem like many people knew about us. And so we started getting people to know us. So interestingly, the city of Chaska was at the same time that they were putting together a plan for their Clover Field development, which was a plan to have a varied new community that had all sorts of pieces of a working community, including a grade school, a park, a transit hub, condos, high buck housing, affordable home ownership, and rental housing and affordable rental housing. All of those components were built into their plan from the very beginning. At the same time they were finishing up their planning, I happened to be doing a presentation and met Kevin Ringwald down there. And they saw this as a good fit, that we were the tool that could put the capstone on their Cloverfield development with the rental and affordable rental, and for that matter, neighborhood-scale commercial space. And so we teamed up with them and went forward to make it happen. So that's kind of how, is that what you meant? Is that what you meant by the question? So that's kind of how it got out there. You know, I often say to when I do presentations is we're just a tool. We're like a hammer. And we just lie in the middle of the table doing nothing. Unless, quite frankly, this community, including you, picks us up and uses us. Our job, as I see it, is to make ourselves the best tool we can be, the best hammer that we can be. And then it's the community's job to pick us up and decide whether or not you're going to swing us and make some good things happen.
Any other questions? Well, if not, I thank you very much for coming, and I do think we'll talk a little bit about maybe a tour of some of the properties if people are interested. And again, I appreciate your being here today.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representatives, thank you very much. Good luck with your work.
Thank you. Next would be Mr. Arnie Anderson, Community Action Partnership. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Anderson. Yeah, if you have some witnesses, go ahead and bring them up and move some chairs around there if you need to.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for having us with you today. We recognize that it's only January.
Will you just give your name and.
My name is Arnie Anderson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. We're the Association of Minnesota's 28 community action agencies. I was going to say that we recognize that it's only January, and already minutes in front of your committee are very precious. So while I'm making a couple of introductory remarks, if you could pull this blue report from your packet, please, I just have a couple of comments to make on this. And turn specifically to pages 18 and 19.
Pages 13 first, did you say?
18 and 19, please. There are two quick points that I would like to try to make, and then we have three witnesses from around Minnesota, from southeast Minnesota, from Minneapolis, and from Duluth. The first point that I would like to try to stress today is that in community action agencies, you have a large statewide network of nonprofit agencies that partner with faith communities, private sector foundations, and the public sector in each of your communities. We have a very difficult time telling our story on a statewide basis because so much of community actions work occurs locally. Your local community action agency communicates with each of you members. The thing that we like to say about community action is that when you've seen one community action agency, you've seen one community action agency. And so the witnesses today will give you just a little snapshot of what we do. With respect to pages 18 and 19, yesterday I think you had some very powerful testimony from one of our friends and partners, Michael Thal, and the Coalition for the Homeless. And if you look in the housing section on page 18, you'll see that or under the emergency services, you'll see that community action agencies helped 13,000 homeless families and provided transitional housing to nearly 1,000 families last year. When you're talking about homeless shelters, you're talking about community action. When you're talking about almost anyone that comes before your committee, somehow or other, they're bumping into or partnering with community action. On any of these program activities, we'd be thrilled to have the opportunity to put together a tour and present some of the powerful audiovisual aids that you saw yesterday and tell you a heart-wrenching and a heartwarming story about what we do in community action. We serve nearly 200,000 Minnesotans in any given year. And with that, I'd like to conclude my introductory remarks and introduce our witnesses. First today, we're going to hear from SEMCAC in southeast Minnesota, Rushford. And we have Vicki Helen from SEMCAC and Tim Cordish, who is someone that has been working with SEMCAC the last couple years.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. If you just introduce yourself, please.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Vicki Helen, and I work with SEMCAC Community Action in Fribourg County. My primary job there is to work with the housing issues, and a component of that is our homeless shelter. So I coordinate the homeless shelter and interview people to come into our shelter. We take families first into our shelter, and then we do take singles as well as if we have room. We actually have three units. Families can stay up to 90 days. in our shelter, which an average, I would say, is probably about 80 days. When they come to the shelter, you know, families are at the very end. They've reached, exhausted all their resources, family, friends, and it's very hard for them to come into the shelter and say that they need a place to live. So they come into our shelter, and we try to give them just not only a place to live, but we try to support them in any way that we possibly can. And that's usually to hook them up as soon as possible with the resources in the community. They come into our office. We don't have phones and things like that in the shelter, so they come into our office daily, use our telephones, ask us about jobs we might know about. It might be mental health issues. It could be a domestic abuse. We receive referrals from all over the community. And one of the things that I wanted to say was that our community is very, very supportive of our shelter. You know, when these families are finally ready to enter back out into the community, they have nothing. You know, they have no furniture. They have no household things. And our community is wonderful about donating furniture, household items, dishes, towels, anything, you name it. And they come and they deliver it to our individuals. And it's a huge piece because it keeps them connected to that community as well, not just to us. But we also try to do budgeting, anything that we consider is an issue. And I could go into lots of different stories, but instead I would rather introduce you to Kim and let Kim tell you her own experience.
Kim? Good morning. Thank you for having me. I was in a shelter from...
Kim, could you just for the tape? This is so that we have it for our records. We'll know your name and...
Oh, Kim Porch.
Yeah.
I was in the shelter from February 05 until September 05. I spent 6 months there. I lived in subsidized housing, Channelview Apartments in Albert Lea, for a couple years. And towards the last 6 months that I was there, I was experiencing a lot of health problems. I was in and out of the hospital 4 or 5 times. The month before I went into the shelter, I was cold-blued because of respiratory infection. So there was mold or... something growing in the townhouse that I was living in. They were unkept. But I stayed in a hotel, me and my kids, and I had nowhere to go. And I called up to SEMCAC, and fortunately they had a unit open, because otherwise I didn't, you know, I'd went into my townhouse, I'd been in there for 5 minutes, and got to the point where I couldn't breathe. I had an asthma attack, you know, within 8 minutes, and I couldn't stay there. I couldn't pack my stuff up or anything. So I called SEMCAC, and they had a unit open, so myself and children went there. And we stayed there for 6 months, but during that time, they helped me. I purchased a house. I'm a homeowner now, but I had debts to pay off, and with phone calls to make and faxes and stuff to pay off these debts to purchase a house, they'd help me with. And there's also community technologies that is connected with that, which is a counseling place, which I have bipolar and ADHD, so, and depression. So they've been supportive there. You know, they helped me. There was counselors there that offered support. And I don't know. I just, I don't know what I would have done without them. The stay there is 90 days, and they allowed me to stay for 6 months, being I was, you know, working to purchasing a home. And they, you know, I don't know what I would have done without them, and they were wonderful. So I did purchase a home, and like I said, I've owned it since September 19th of 05, and I still talk to them every month, and they're very, you know, supportive and wonderful. So that's all I got to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. It's very inspiring.
Thanks.
While they're coming to the microphone, I'd like to introduce Stan Kuykers and John Bolander from Duluth, and they will be here to talk a little bit more about some specific programming that community actions agencies do to help low-income Minnesotans to build their assets.
Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself on the tape, please.
My name is Stan Pipers. I'm Executive Director of Community Action Duluth. We're here to talk to you particularly about our asset development program at Community Action, and in particular our experience over the last, since 2000, in with the FAME program, Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota. It's a 3-to-1 mass savings account that allows savers to acquire the assets of home ownership, small business, or going back to school. And with me today is John Bolander, who's going to talk a little bit about his experiences in, as a saver towards that college education asset. Before I turn it over to John, I just want to emphasize that Duluth is a bit removed and out of the mainstream sometimes in Minnesota, but I'm pleased to say that our asset development program and our FAME program is the largest in the state of Minnesota. We have over 100 people at the moment saving for home ownership, education, and going back to school. On the white handout that you received is sort of a demonstration of the economic aspect, the economic benefits of our FAME program in our community. It really does, we've had 12 businesses start since the program's inception in 2000. John is one of 23 individuals who are taking advantage of the education asset. And we've had 23, I believe, home ownership opportunities or assets that have been cashed in for home ownership in the past 12 months. So we're very supportive of the legislature's funding for FAME. We've been able to lock in on the federal level to our one of the $3 or one and a half of the $3 that provide that 3-to-1 match up through, I believe, 2008 or 9. We're well ahead. In fact, one of the biggest challenges we have is finding the funding to run the program. The match dollars are there, the people like John are there, and we, the coaching dollars and the staffing dollars don't always come along. And that's where you all come in when it comes to considering the state funding that comes to Community Action through the Minnesota Community Action Grants. The 55% reduction that we took in 2003 took a bit of a whack out of our ability to respond and to have more savers like John. The other aspect that I'll mention just very briefly, and it ties into John's story as well, is another piece of the asset development program is our tax preparation. We just opened our tax site in Duluth last Saturday. We had 37 people come in. They kind of take over our office. It gives me an opportunity to clean my desk twice a week on Saturdays and Tuesdays, Tuesday evenings and Saturday days. And we're hoping to serve over 500 people this year in Duluth. You can see from the white sheet again the millions of dollars in assets that we return to the Duluth economy. So the programs that we operate aren't always just hand-ups. They're also, they do have a turnaround effect. When we ask people at the tax site, like John did last night, well, what are you going to use your tax refund for? Most people say paying bills, catching up on my insurance, my water and gas bill, et cetera, et cetera. So we're working very hard to make sure those assets are accounted for and put to good use. I'll now turn the mic over to John Bonlander and let him tell you about his experience in FAME as an education saver.
My name is John Bonlander. Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, it's nice to see you. I'll make this quick. My story is I'm a 42-year-old single father. I was injured 3 years ago, so therefore I had to decide what I was going to do. Prior to that, I ran a youth center in Duluth, and because of what happened in my injury, I am no longer able to stand up for 8 hours a day chasing teenagers. So I had to decide what I was going to do, and I decided I wanted to be an accountant. I always liked it. I thought I should have done it years ago, but I just didn't get around to it. And so I heard about the FAME program. And the good news about the FAME program is is it's not only state or federal money, there's my money in there too. You know, I put up really essentially a quarter, you know, it's matched 3-1. But then it gives me an opportunity to have a say about what I do with that money. And it relieves the pressure of child, you know, having a child. Being able to use that money for school at the current time, I needed a printer that was worthy of online classes. I needed a monitor. I had to take an art class to get a degree. And you know, as I say, if I could do it, it ain't art. I had some anxiety over this art class, so I had a, there's a digital photography class, so but I didn't have a camera. So I, through FAMA, I was able to get a camera to take that class. So there's a million good things that come out of FAMA. Also, we have the biometric tax site, voluntary income tax assistance, which I am lucky enough to be a part of, being an accounting student. I know a little bit about that. Had a year of tax, and it also gives me an opportunity to get back. You know, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. One more item, Madam Chair, representatives. I just want to draw your attention again back to the yellow sheet and the first bullet under the highlights and key results. I talked about the impact of FAME in Duluth, but statewide, I just want you to, again, read that that bullet point. The fact that we've assisted over 700 people with saving towards nearly $600,000 over that period of time, and you can see the breakdown of the assets. The majority of them seem to be going for home ownership, but education is also a very popular asset saving goal. So I just want you to know statewide we're following through on our commitment, and we believe using taxpayer dollars very wisely.
Thank you very much. Representative Trumper, did you have a question?
No,
okay, then Representative Peterson.
In looking at the brochure and at the different in the contents of all the different organizations, community action agencies, one of the things I see as a common thread is about tax returns. And your statements say earned income tax credit is our nation's most effective and efficient anti-poverty program because it results in cash in pockets. I'm a dummy. Would you explain to me the earned income tax credit? Why is that a consistent theme?
I'll do my best. The earned income tax credit is sort of an equalizer. If you're a single mother with three kids and you've only been able to work part-time at Kmart and last year you earned $7,000, when you come in to have your taxes done, we look at that income, and there's a standard that says for a family of four,
okay,
you ought to make a certain amount.
Right.
And so we see earned income tax credits equalizing that income out as high as $6,000 or $7,000.
Oh, so they can just apply for the, Madam Chair, the refund then. So that's the importance of doing the tax return.
And you should also know that the earned income tax credit has a Minnesota version, the Minnesota family, you know, someone. Minnesota
Family
tax
credit.
Thank you. Should have asked John. So those two programs, along with free taxes, helping folks to prevent them from taking out predatory loans, getting an H&R Block credit card before Christmas, and saving people the 500-600% interest on those loans. We believe the cumulative effect of that is very positive. I should also mention that one of the requirements of John when he saved for as he's saving for his education asset is that he met with a counselor at Lake Superior College. They agreed and set a plan towards his achieving his accounting degree. That's a requirement. The only other requirement, in addition to his saving, is that he attend a financial literacy class that we teach in our office. It's called the Four Cornerstone Project. And so virtually everyone who comes through our doors, not the tax set folks, but all of our FAME participants, learn how to manage money, not that they didn't before. In fact, the teaching is very much a a group process of learning from one another. So we view that financial, getting smart on your finances is a key component. I'm sorry, I digress from your question, Representative.
That's great.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, one of the results that we achieve in community action are these tax credits. And in 2005, through the voluntary efforts at community action agencies, we were able to recover $22 million in tax credit, much of which is federal money flowing into Minnesota and flowing into local merchants that would not have otherwise been available.
Hmm. Fascinating.
And I just wanted to ask you a question. I think at your last comment on the handout sheet was that securing funding for non-match activities at the coaching is challenging. And I think you did mention that in 2003 there was a 55% reduction to the program. Where are we at now with the actual returning at least to the 2003 level? Have we been there yet?
I think we've had bills written in the last couple of years, but we've not gone very far in that process. So we're still at the funding level that came out of both the governor's unilateral action and the legislature's actions from 2003. So we're still at that same funding level for Minnesota Community Action Grants. Meanwhile, on the federal level, we've been zeroed out for the last 2 years in the president's budget, perhaps even longer. The last two are the only ones I can remember, and we've managed to hold our own, and we're operating under a continuing resolution there as well. So we're probably at about 2004 federal funding level for our Community Services Block Grant, CSBG.
Members, let me just share something with you. Thank you for that history, by the way, and I know there's going to be a bill this year to, or at least I hope you're bringing forth a bill to remind us what a good investment this is. Just want to share with members, I was one of the original authors of this bill, but it happened to be the year before the Republicans took back chair of the control of the House. And so the following year, at that time my colleague Representative Pawlenty took the bill and carried it all the way through and passed it. And so the governor has shown leadership in this area, and even though he also cut it in 2003, it looks like, we can certainly talk about working with him, I hope, to look at the investment. And I really invite you to just remind us and all of us in whatever way is possible of what we get on the return on our money, just the percentage, and you don't need to do any more of that right now. You've done a good job, very good job, but I just encourage you to do that as you visit maybe with committee members.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We look forward to working with you on this.
Thank you. Any other questions? Then we'll move on.
Community action agencies in Minnesota provide an infrastructure to respond to many things in both an organized fashion and sometimes in an unexpected fashion. They've been available to respond to the tornado in St. Peter. They're available to respond to the flood in the Red River Valley. And one of the things, one of the qualities of community action is that after all the sexy part of a disaster has passed, there still is a lot of work that remains. And that usually is where community action steps up. And so today we have Community Action Minneapolis to speak to you, Wanda Muhammad and Alexander Folks. And they're here to tell you how Hurricane Katrina made its way to Minnesota.
Good morning. My name is Wanda Muhammad.
Welcome to the committee.
I'm the Director of Children and Family Development with Community Action of Minneapolis. We have an office located in the Phillips area as well as in the Degree Institute. We provide many services, energy assistance, weatherization, and also self-sufficiency and community empowerment programs. With our CSBG and our state-funded dollars, it allows us to be flexible to respond to needs. We receive TANF and PHP funds for our new lease on life transitional housing program. When Hurricane Katrina hit, one of the things that our agency did in response to that large number of families that we heard were moving to Minnesota is that we prepared kits where we put together household items and things that people can't go to the store and buy with food stamps. We had things like deodorant, toothpaste, cleaning supplies. We were able to serve, in collaboration with the faith-based community and other nonprofits, over 100 families. Another thing that we decided to do with our housing funds was to focus on families who had been relocated and displaced here. And so we look at housing and our programs like rest. Every morning when we get up and you suck in, you need it to live. It's basic. After that, we provide integrated and comprehensive services, including counseling, financial management, life skills management, employment search, whatever the family needs to get readjusted. And for families coming from Mississippi, New Orleans, it was quite an adjustment for them. Once we get them in and get them stabilized, we do prevention. We want them to be stable once we have stepped out. So we're teaching them those skills. And the last thing I'll say is that we believe that we're building a greater Minneapolis, one family at a time, which ultimately it results in a greater Minnesota. So with that, I will introduce Alexander to tell you a little bit about his story coming from Mississippi.
Welcome to the committee, and if you'll just say your name for the tape, please.
Good morning. How y'all doing? My name is Alexander Forbes. I moved here from Vicksburg, Mississippi, August 24th of 2006, me and my fiance. We came here looking for a better and brighter future. We both are educated, and Mississippi didn't offer a whole lot of opportunity as far as being able to make a wage, which is a living wage, that you would want to have. And when I came here, I lived with a couple of relatives for maybe about 2 weeks. And after about 2 weeks, you know, they say fish can come and spend after a while. You know, I had to find myself in a position where I had to make a bigger transition faster than I was anticipating. So in that transition, I was out about doing the city one day, and I ran into a young lady, and she was telling me about community action. So I gave it a try, and I went by, and I spoke with the administrative assistant. And as soon as I got through telling her about my situation, she pretty much just told me, said, you know, you've been blessed to be able to come here and somebody give you the direction as to which way to go in life. That's what pretty much Community Action has done for me. It's given me a sense of direction as to which way to go. It has helped me to put me in a position to be able to house myself, work on my finances, where I've been able to manage my finances a lot better, pay off some of my bills. I'm currently working a living wage job with good benefits. I am now enrolled in High Tech Institute to take up surgical technology, and everything's been going great. I've only been here 5 months, and I just say I thank God to be able to be here. Mississippi, coming from Mississippi and going through the situation, Hurricane Katrina, it was rough. And our city has sustained a lot of extra people once that hurricane come through, because the Gulf Coast was really torn up, New Orleans was torn up, and then everybody was coming there, and the jobs that were available, they were pretty much being taken. So it pretty much just forced you in a position where you have to either stay and put up with it, or you can leave and try to do a little better. And I just chose the latter, to do a little bit better, and it was a great move. Community Action is, to me, my definition of community action, what I see community action, self-sufficiency. Successfully enduring life's fractures, sometimes uncertain peaks, focusing, intensifying, concentration, instantly encouraging necessary transformations, and that's what it's done for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. Questions from committee members? I just want to say it's really good to meet a person who has come through all that you did with Katrina, and I'm glad you were here to tell us your story. Let me just ask, Ms. Muhammad, did you say there were about 100 families that are here from?
Yes.
Relocated from Katrina?
Families through the hurricane relief effort that we were aware of. We worked with many churches and other community organizations that contacted us to say, you know, we have a family. So, you know, anywhere in Minneapolis, we can serve families. So we get that phone call, we're going to respond. And that's the beauty of having the CSPG and the Community Action Grant, to be able to change direction and meet the needs of the people instantly.
And if I could ask you, are most of the families in the Twin Cities areas, are some of them in other parts of Minnesota?
Some of them were are in other parts of Minnesota. There were a lot of families that ended up in St. Paul, and we even stretched across the boundaries to help with families as well.
Thank you very much. Representative Moe, did you have a question?
No, Chair, just a quick point. First, I would like to welcome you to Minnesota, and I hope the agency helped you all get good coats.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the chance to appear before you today. And we also consider Colleen Moriarty and Hunger Solutions to be great friends, and I hope that we didn't step on their time.
Thank you. We're doing just fine, and that was a nice lead-in to our next presentation, which is from Hunger Solutions. And Ms. Moriarty, I want to welcome you to the committee and bring forth your witnesses. While we're waiting, members, we do have the minutes from the last meeting, and let's just take a moment. And Representative Benson, have you had a chance to look over the minutes?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I did approach the system and the CCAP solution.
Okay. I think there was one error on there that we
thought. New aide mismarked my calendar, I'm afraid, and I wasn't aware.
That's okay. We have a correction to the minutes, which was that you were excused.
Thank you.
No problem.
Indulgence.
Okay. So I'll take your motion then to approve the minutes as corrected. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes, and the minutes are approved. Welcome to the committee, and
thank you, Madam Chair.
You had a nice introduction.
I did. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Colleen Moriarty, and I am the Executive Director of Hunger Solutions Minnesota, and we as well consider the community action agencies to be great partners of ours, both in the state and the federal level as we move forward to help serve people who live in poverty. I'm here today to describe to you the crushing needs that have the members of our community, indeed the citizens in the state of Minnesota, using an emergency food system as a way to make it through the month. In 2005, Hunger Solutions Minnesota engaged in the fifth study that we've done. We do them every 5 years to look at the usage of food shelters and feeding programs around the state. There are approximately 305 food shelves, a little bit more than that now, and 52 on-site feeding programs in the state of Minnesota. And in 2004, there were 576,275 individuals representing households that made 1.7 million visits to food shelves and received 36.3 million pounds of food. That represents a 45% increase in the amount of visits to food shelves throughout the state of Minnesota, and a 90% increase in the past 20 years. Those of you who have food shelves in your communities, and I'm sure all of you do, have seen this increase result in things that have come that have been mentioned in the news in the past several weeks. Service has been curtailed in Detroit Lakes. Service has been curtailed in Park Rapids. Service has been curtailed at the Division of Indian Works in Minneapolis. When I mean service, I mean not just the availability of hours, but the kind of food and the availability of food. In the early 70s, the emergency food system really began as a response to the fact that there was a surplus of some commodities that could be distributed to people in need in our country. The emergency food system has responded well in the face of dire disasters, in the faces of Katrina, in the faces of tornadoes. But the emergency food system does not operate as an emergency food system in the state of Minnesota, in the surrounding upper Midwest, or in this country as a whole. The emergency food system gives people confidence in the fact that food is not optional in the state of Minnesota. There are recommendations that are included in the report. The executive summary is provided to each member of the committee, along with the document that details the work that we've been engaged in the past year with a broad coalition of people who are looking to increase this funding for food shelves in the state of Minnesota. Joining me today are two representatives of our community and two of our partners. Dan Hawksworth is the president of Neighborhood House, and Shirley Bueller is the project coordinator for ICA. And each one of them are going to speak to you about their recommendations and their personal experiences in the emergency food service provisions in the state of Minnesota. So I'd like to welcome both of them, and I certainly would stand available for any questions that you have at the conclusion of their testimony. Thank you. Dan?
Thank you, Colleen. My name is Dan Hawksworth. It's my privilege to be the president of Neighborhood House, a 110-year-old settlement house community center located on the west side of St. Paul. And we now operate out of our new facility, the Living Memorial to Paul and Sheila Wellstone, the Paul and Sheila Wellstone Center for Community Building. It is often said that the true test of a nation's prosperity and its value is how it treats its most vulnerable members. And as you have heard, we are failing this test as a community. Children are truly going hungry in our community and across our state. And hunger is no longer an occasional emergency. For many families in our state, it has become a chronic condition that they and their children face on a daily basis. Neighborhood House has responded to the rise in hunger by increasing the efficiency and effectiveness of virtually every aspect of our food shelf operation, to enable us to provide more food to more families, to connect these families to other vital resources and services to assist them. This efficiency has enabled us to increase the amount of food we provide from 75,000 pounds in 1999 to 238,000 pounds in 2005 to 360,000 pounds in 2006. Let me repeat those figures for you. That was 75,000 pounds in 1999, 238,000 pounds in 2005, and 360,000 pounds this past year. We are now the second largest food shelf in Ramsey County. We have assisted nearly 8,500 individuals with food in 2006. Of these, 40% were employed, 22% were on fixed incomes, and 25% were recent refugees to the United States. 87% fall into those three categories. For all of our work, we were recently honored to be recognized by the Emergency Food Shelf Network as the Outstanding Food Shelf in Minnesota in 2006. But what we're doing is not enough to meet the hunger. We supply an average of 10.8 pounds of food per family member versus the standard that really would call us to have 14 to 16 pounds per family member. We have a waiting list of families that we simply don't have enough staff or food to assist them every week. So I am clearly not satisfied. I hope you aren't satisfied. I believe we all are falling short. And we are not alone. Other organizations are struggling to meet demand, as Colleen said. It is truly crippling agency budgets, or it is forcing them to close their food shelves, both in greater Minnesota, but I know of many instances in St. Paul area as well, to close early or turn away customers. I know one local food shelf had to close for the entire month of December, which is a crucial time for families. The hardship of this is truly felt by those needing the food, and our amazing staff and volunteers who staff our food shelves. It is our staff and volunteers who have to convey the impact of public policy decisions made in this august body to the people on the street. It is our staff and volunteers who see the pain of the hunger in the eyes of a child and the look of despair and failure in the eyes of a parent whose child is hungry. And it is our staff who have to turn people away. For the long run, we are working very hard with our excellent food bank partners to secure more food. We are working to enhance our delivery system with our food shelves. The Greater Twin Cities United Way Hunger Task Force, on which I serve, is working to increase the supply of food by 20% by 2009. With United Way and our food bank and other partners at the table, I'm sure we will make that happen, that is, increase the amount of food by 20%. But I am not sure it will be enough. In fact, I know it won't be enough. Without a commitment by our state and you, its policymakers, we will not end hunger in Minnesota. with a commitment, like the commitment that the state is starting to make to homelessness, we can commit, we can end hunger in our state. And these days, there's one story and one child that I met that I can't get out of my mind. Her name's Anna. Anna came into our food shelf with her mother, Maria. After meeting with our state, with our staff for our 45-minute intake to help the family set goals, Maria and Anna went to shop for food in our food shelf. We have a choice model there that is being replicated. Anna tagged along, and as soon as they entered the food shelf, she saw the box of fruit roll-ups, and she grabbed one with her hand. She'd been so patient for all that time, her mom said that was fine, and she just held on to that fruit roll-up in one hand. And then they went about shopping, choosing groceries that they will use as a family. That way, 98% of the food that leaves our food shelf is eaten. None of it sits on the shelf or gets returned to another food shelf because they don't know what to use it for. So they continued shopping, and as they were done, Maria and Anna started moving out of the food shelf and moved the cart to the hallway. Well, Maria said, Anna, let's go get our car, and we'll come back and get the groceries. Anna reached up, still holding the fruit roll-up in one hand, and grabbed the cart with the other hand. And her mom said, come with me, Anna. Please come with me. And she started screaming, Mommy, don't leave me. I'm not going to leave this food. Her mom asked one of our workers to stay with Anna. Maria went and got her car, pulled it around to the back of the building where they brought the food, and every step of the way, there was Anna with the cart, with the fruit roll-up, holding on to both because she didn't want that food to get away. She didn't let go of that cart until they put all that food in the cart. I still see Anna holding on to that cart. I can't get that image out of my mind. How long had she been without food? How hungry was she to let her mother leave rather than abandon the food? What four-year-old would have to make that choice? Why should any four-year-old have to? I truly believe there is no reason any four-year-old should ever experience hunger in our state. We are prosperous enough. If we are to leverage our investments in education, we have to see that children are fed so they can grow and develop, so they can focus and think in the classroom. So let's make a commitment that no child in Minnesota is going to go hungry. No child will go hungry in this state. Please do this for all the Annas in our community. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dale. And now... Shirley,
welcome to the committee. My name is Shirley Dealer. I'm a project coordinator for ICA Food Shelf. We are the only food shelf in the western suburbs. We are supported by 33 congregations and two synagogues in the western suburbs. It used to be said that if you lived in the western suburbs, you were an affluent family, you didn't need assistance. Well, we're proof. We're there. And we're active. We're good stewards. We use the resources that are given to us. When the resources go away, we try to be good stewards of what we have. And I think we proved that we have done that. It seems like we give food out to all these families, and that's the first priority. Our second priority is to look at other needs. And other needs are keeping them in housing and jobs, and then when they have a job, getting them to work. We give them food for 7 days and encourage self-sufficiency by supplying two social workers so that we can try to see what the problem is before it becomes a crisis. When we call ourselves an emergency food shelf, you think everyone that comes to us is in an emergency, and they are, but we want to give them the resources that are going to keep them from getting into crisis. And that's to help them find food stamps help from Hennepin County if they need it. Of course, find a job, medical assistance, and affordable housing, which is a big, big issue right now. With cuts in the human resources and food support, we're seeing more middle-class families coming to us, struggling to make ends meet. It just takes one emergency to throw them into crisis nowadays. It seems like people don't have anything to fall back on. And if they do fall back on something, it's usually their parents, grandpas and grandmas with children of families that just can't make it. We help them try to find a job because most of the time it's a job loss, a medical emergency, car repairs that cause this situation to become full-blown. So providing them with social workers to help them meet these emergencies before they become crisis, we're finding is important. Housing seems to be a big hurdle for most of our clients because since 2000, the wages have gone up 12% and the housing has gone up 20%. So we are seeing people who are living in unaffordable housing. In the last 6 years, we've done a housing program which has really, in effect, brought our community together. John Kopich has leaped in the tent. It's made youth and confirmation and churches rally around his efforts for one cause, and that is to help people be able to stay in their housing. Between 2000 and 2005, we experienced a 352% increase in food services. You've heard it. It's there. It's not going to go away. We're thinking that we're going to conquer this. The mayor of Minnetonka said, we won't need a food shelf in Minnetonka by 2010. Well, you know what? Get with the real world. We're having people move out to Minnetonka. They're thinking they can find better jobs there. Once they get there, they're not being able to get that job that's going to pay for that housing. Between 2001 and 2006, we assisted 579 households with housing assistance. That tells you what the need is. In those households were 663 children that we kept in a stable home, in a stable school situation, which was so important to most of those children. 43% of our services go to children, and 60% of our clients are working people. The stigma that if you get welfare or if you get food stamps or if you go to the food shelf, you're not working, you're not looking for work. That's no more. Transportation is always a problem for us. We're always giving as much as we can. We use our discretionary funds for gas vouchers. We know that if we can get people into jobs, that they have to sustain those jobs. And right now, it's a struggle. You all know it. You have to come to the Capitol, and that costs you a lot of money. We're trying to help these people, once they find the jobs, stay in them, and that's by helping them with energy costs. Car repairs, and that's always going to be an ongoing problem because they aren't making the wages that will require for the gas to go up. We have a ride program that we offer. It's for handicapped and seniors who do not have transportation. That program is increasing, of course, with the weather now. If they do have a vehicle, it isn't starting, or they can't afford the gas to put it in, so they aren't getting to their doctor's appointments. We offer this ride program, and we also deliver groceries to anyone who requires it. Right now, when we take intake for our clients, being an emergency food shelf, we ask them first thing, what's your emergency? Well, most of the time, it's the normal, lost the job. My wife had to quit working because childcare was so expensive. We couldn't afford it. We lost our benefits because we took a job that was not 32 hours a week or didn't offer benefits. So now we're taking anything for an emergency. And most of the time, it's a fixed income because a lot of our people are seniors that are all getting Social Security. That wage is not going to increase as fast as their expenses are. You had a story, and I have a story, and I've told this story so many times because it just broke my heart. We had a senior that called us from one of our senior high-rise, and she said, you know, I was doing great. I was getting along on my Social Security. I had $5 for gas. I had $5 for my church. And she said, all of a sudden, my copays went up $40 a month more. And she said, I'm ashamed to tell my grandchildren that I'm coming to the food shelf. So we're seeing our seniors that are being in the situation of being ashamed. And that's not acceptable for me. How about you? Thank you.
Thank you so much. Excuse me, Ms. Mariani. Before we go forward and you can do this more time, I just wanted to let the committee know that we are being visited by 11th and 12th grade students who are here from Faith Christian Church in Forston, Minnesota, and we want to welcome you, the committee. I'm really glad you're here for this testimony.
Just to recap, the food shelf usage in the state of Minnesota has grown by 45% in the last 5 years, 90% in the last 20 years. Women and children and people of color are the disproportionate number of people who are hungry. Employment, disability, and retirement are the major sources of income for people who visit food shelves. Affordable housing is a major issue that many people who visit food shelves are encountering, and in fact, this dovetails with much of the testimony you've had this morning and previously in your committee about housing and about the fact that that has a dramatic impact on people. Cutting back or skipping meals is increasing and remains commonplace among those who are use food assistance. And this program within the state of Minnesota since its inception in 1995 has remained flat. It's received no increase, and we are working to bring forward a bill asking for a 45% increase to serve food shelves throughout the state of Minnesota. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And we have a number of people who want to ask some questions. Representatives Swales, Medora, Benson, and Cran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I first of all just want to thank everyone who has testified today on the various issues related to the homeless and now to hunger in Minnesota. I think all of you are helping us so much understand a very broad issue and also one that is requiring a lot of attention. I've had the great privilege for the last couple of years of being the state advisor for National Honor Society, and each year we choose a project to benefit a statewide concern. And last year, National Honor Society chose supporting food banks across the state. My particular area was raising funds for Second Harvest, which serves our community and our area. I know that many thousands of dollars were raised by various high schools across the state, but I am wondering, because I didn't know this until we selected that project, that there is a difference between a food bank and a food shelf.
Right.
And I think it would be very helpful to the committee if you would explain the differences and how the food bank is able to support the 300 and some food shelves that we have in our state.
I'd be happy to, Madam Chair, members of the committee. A food shelf is really a local response where a participant comes to gain service. When you think of a food bank, you think of a large distribution center that receives donations both from the wonderful work that you did and from corporate sponsors and from government programs like TFAP and others, and then works on an equity basis throughout the state of Minnesota to distribute those things to the food shelves. So the food banks in Minnesota are represented by America's Second Harvest, both in Crookston, in Rochester, in Duluth, in Fargo, in Minneapolis, and St. Paul. And there are other independent food banks, including the Emergency Food Shelf Network, of which we made mention to, and another program which has been new to our community but has been very helpful called Hope for the Cities. So there are various responses to this, but the food banks really are a cooperative agreement among many nonprofit partners based on a national level with America's Second Harvest that distributes food at a very low cost. And really, the cost is really just representative of the cost of transportation. And at that, with the transportation costs rising as they have in the past several years, really being able to even cover those basic costs has been a challenge for them. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Madore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a little tough this morning to sit through. Mm-hmm. I have to tell you, this is a hard committee.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to say, I met a child like Anna. I work a lot with special needs families, and often they're pushed to the edge with, I'm sorry, I should have waited to ask the question.
It's a good way to be a legislator.
I'm embarrassed that we have four-year-olds that are hungry,
mm-hmm.
and they're in my community. But oftentimes these families are pushed to the edge with their medical bills, and they don't qualify for services, or they're too humiliated to go through the process of applying for these services. And I just want to say, you know, that mom, while she's sitting with you there for 45 minutes and you're trying to talk to her about priorities, she can hear her little girl's tummy growling. And all she wants to do is say, please, just let me get out of here with some dignity. And I know how excited my kids are when I bring home a new snack or a new treat that they've seen on television. I can only imagine how that four-year-old must have looked at that box of roll-ups and said, I've never had this before, or all my friends have it, and I can't wait to go home and eat it. So I'm really not asking a question. I just want to say thank you for the hard work that you do, because it's got to be an incredibly exhausting day at the end of the day. I know how exhausted I am just meeting one family. I can't imagine how you do it. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to discuss with Ms. Bueller here your comments about Minnetonka and the governor. I mean, not the governor, but the mayor. I represent part of Minnetonka, of course, and part of Plymouth. And maybe you and I could sit down together and we could come up with a good way, a gentle way of informing those in city government who might need a little help in that area.
Hallelujah. Jump on the ship.
Secondly, I'm just wondering, the distribution center that's being built by St. David's Church, you are directly tied. I'd be interested in just a very brief discussion of how all that came about, if you would.
Sure.
And then I attended the Second Harvest seminar that was held here earlier this fall, and there was a discussion there about the difficulty many have separating out, in a sense, the need for food from all the other kinds of needs. Now, I know they're all interconnected, but it seems there's a psychological glitch going on in which those who say to themselves, well, we have these social problems and we have these needs all the time, it's all kind of in more of the same. And to me, there is a difference between a child who's hungry today and the long-term needs for affordable housing and all the rest. Do you have a strategy to help those who have this difficulty understand that we're talking about something that is important now, today, and that this is a moral imperative?
Well, you notice that I said our first responsibility is to feed our family. And we consider that a big responsibility. No matter how many times they would ask to come to the food shelf, which we normally say once a month, and we give out 20 pounds of food per person. We're figuring that will last each person 7 days. You know, we're not wanting to be their sole source of food, so that's why we're hooking them up to food stamps and Fair Share and other programs. We run all these programs. Yes, you're right. We have a housing program, we have a food program, and we've had our capital campaign program. So always our business has been food. And I would like to think that no one in Minnetonka does not know where to go to find us and to get those resources. We publicize. We have 300 volunteers that volunteer for us. And so we try by word of mouth. Between those 33 congregations and synagogues, we hope that their parishioners know about us. We know that all of our pastors of those congregations know about us. And we encourage them to send them, the clients that are in need, send them to us. We can resource them into all different kinds of programs. But yes, you're right. Food is the number one priority.
Thank you.
In regards to the communications of these services, does the City of Minnetonka or the City of Plymouth assist in any way in getting this information out?
The City of Minnetonka leases our building to us, and they figure that it's their responsibility put out for us. But we have two facilities right now, one on Williston Road, which is our administrative offices, but we also serve Hopkins and Minnetonka out of that. And then we have a warehousing facility in the old fire station in Excelsior. And that is used where we do our sorting and packing. We used to have all kinds of storage sheds and collect our food there and then bring it all into Minnetonka and distribute it. Well, we grew too fast. We grew out of that building. And the fact is, 5 years ago, we recognized that growth. As you can see, we saw it growing every year. So we started working with our ministers or our rabbis in our area. And we had that wonderful base of 33 congregations. And so we started working with them to try and find a location that would make us good stewards of what we wanted to do. And St. David was the congregation that stepped up, gave us the property to build a facility on. It's a $100,000 facility. Right now, we have that facility funded except for $200,000. People have stepped up to support that. And we are going to be good stewards by putting our two facilities into one and making it easier for our 300 volunteers to work. We're not going to be transporting food back and forth from Excelsior to Minnetonka. So we're trying to be good stewards, and we're also then trying not to have a mortgage. We know that we are lean and mean as it is. We cannot afford a mortgage. And so we're working toward that goal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have a visitor who's come from out of town, a testifier, so I wanted to have one more question, and then I'm going to ask the members if you could stay an extra few minutes. Do you want to say one on that? Okay.
Yeah, I have just a very brief question. I did notice you refer to them as clients, and I think I and they will appreciate that. But my question is if you can speak to the percent of your clients that use you on a short-term basis or a long-term basis, and I guess I don't even know what that, if 6 months, and I'm assuming that you know, those clients come in periodically, but I guess I'm trying to get to the question of how many, what percent of your population uses you on a short-term, between jobs kind of type of idea, or more of a longer-term fix?
You can give a brief response, please.
Well, of course, our goal is to get them in the stable situation. And we do not track. We do not care if they come back in 6 months. We find that a lot of people do come back when they hit another bump in the road. We do see our seniors, some of them coming every month.
Thank you.
Our average is 3 to 4 visits a year overall. But that varies from a seniors who will come monthly, or to our refugees in their first year or two in the United States will come monthly, and then it will taper off.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, statewide, the Hunger Solutions and the Minnesota Food Share have just concluded regional meetings where we've heard from food shelves throughout the entire state of Minnesota, and they're reporting many new faces. In fact, they're reporting that there are many new families that are visiting the food shelf as opposed to people making repetitive visits. So we're seeing the clientele increase and a new group of people visiting the food shelf.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate your testimony. If members want to talk later, we have one final witness. It's come all the way from Houston County, and I'd like to invite her to come forward. Robin Yaffe-Schumper, welcome to the committee. And committee members, if we can stay about an extra 5 minutes, we want to give about 10 minutes to this witness if possible. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Robin Yaffe-Schumper, and thank you for having me today. I'm the executive director of the Houston County Women's Resources. We're a private, nonprofit agency located in Hoka, Minnesota. We're in no way associated with the county. We just happen to be located there.
Okay.
Our services include programs for battered women, abused children, and sexual assault victims. And domestic violence is a major cause of homelessness. We have a 7-unit apartment building with 1 4-bedroom handicapped accessible unit, 3 3-bedroom units, 1 1-bedroom unit, and 2 2-bedroom units. And we also own a 3-bedroom house for a total of 8 units of housing for women and children who are homeless. We also provide safe houses for women who are in need of emergency shelter, and we provide funds for scattered site housing for women and children who also need housing assistance. So obviously housing is a major problem for the individuals that we work with. In 2006, we provided 17 women, 1 man, and 21 children with a total of 156 days in a safe home. And obviously, these individuals had just no safe place to go. Our 8 units of transitional housing remain filled, and we're much more likely to have to turn people away than we are to ever have a vacancy. We do have a waiting list, and our units don't stay vacant for long after a family transitions out. There just isn't enough affordable housing. Houston County is in our far southeast corner of the state, and our area is extremely rural, and there is little available housing to begin with. And then to make the problem worse, living in the country has become highly desirable. Many of the farms and orchards that are in the area are being sold to developers, and houses are being built for higher income brackets. This is driving the cost of rental property up as well, and so the lack of housing and increased property values has really created a problem for individuals that are living below or at poverty. To make the problem even worse, Section 8 housing assistance currently in our area has a 6 to 9 month waiting list. Even in a dire emergency, assistance is unavailable for many months. I'll give you an example that we have now. A woman and her children have been on the run from their abuser. They've moved from city to city throughout the state. They've lived in shelters, in private homes of relatives, and sought out churches in various areas and lived with church members temporarily. And with all of this, their abuser was still able to track the family down and threaten them. With help of an agency similar to ours, they went underground. They've changed their names. They're waiting for new Social Security numbers. And they've sold what possessions they could, and they've moved again. And they're still waiting for Section 8 assistance. We've been able to provide them with housing by tapping into our various funds through grant monies, and we've sought out other financial assistance through local residents, members of our agency, and churches. And this is really a shame. This family has been terrorized to the point of having to change their name and go underground, and they're still having to wait for housing assistance. Another family that we work with consists of 2 women I'll call Dorothy and Gina. They've lived together for many years, mostly on the streets. At one time, they have resorted to living in a cave somewhere near the Twin Cities. One of them has a mental illness, and the other has chronic alcoholism. They have a difficult time retaining their resources, which has often forced them onto the streets. And they're currently living in a very small trailer in a small city in our county, and this is the first stable home that they have ever had. And I also want to tell you about Cheryl. She's a 24-year-old mother of 2, and her children are very young. Her husband was recently arrested for trying to strangle her in the presence of her children. And the day after this event, she and her children were evicted and asked to vacate their rental housing on New Year's Eve. She had no place to go, no money, and no one to help them move their belongings. We helped her find an apartment, paid her security deposit and her first month's rent, and now she's able to focus on her job, which fortunately she was able to retain through the crisis. And although she has to put her children in daycare now, at least they're going to survive with the help of housing assistance. Last Thursday, January 25th, we participated in the state's one-day count of homeless persons for the Homeless Management Information System. And we were to ask a few standardized questions of each client that we had contact with on that particular day. Unfortunately, on that day, I had three staff that were either out on vacation or home ill. And so we only had one person at our facility that day that actually had client contact, and she counted 18 individuals. And these were only the individuals she had contact with that happened to have a disability. And they were either homeless or in a shelter or, you know, seeking assistance for that. And this didn't take into account any of the children that these folks had with them. Fortunately, there are organizations like ours that have grant money available to provide transitional housing and safe housing. That, you know, we're only able to help a few families at a time, and we have very limited funds. There are a lot more families in our area that need housing that don't seek us out. A lot of people have problems that don't align with the mission of our agency. And so they don't have a place to go. They, you know, people lose their jobs every day. They have unexpected health problems. The main financial provider passes away and leaves the family without an income. And, you know, where are these people to go, and can they go for assistance? In many instances, we can't help them, and there are just very few facilities available to refer them. So I do encourage you to increase housing funding for low-income Minnesotans. Minnesota has historically been a leader in taking social action. Actually, the first one of the first women's shelters in the United States was built in St. Paul in 1972. So we have a really proud history of recognizing the needs of the individuals who are battered or abused or maltreated. And so it's a moral imperative that we strive to eradicate homelessness in this great state. It does take commitment, including a commitment to greater funding for housing. So thank you, Madam Chairman and Representatives. I appreciate the time.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? A question I have is, are you part of the whole network of shelters and housing for battered women?
Yes.
And is there going to be a proposal from the network to us here at the legislature this year? Do you know?
I believe so.
Okay.
I can't answer that definitively, okay. But I believe so. Okay. I know we're coming up for, on February 28th is the VAWA, Violence Against Women Day rally, and several of us have made appointments with our legislators and the governor's office. So.
Great. Well, that'll be great. I just wanted to ask you one other question. You said your grant money is available from transitional housing.
Yes.
And what other, other resources?
We have provide scattered site housing. We have a hotel motel safe program. We also do provide safe visitations for children.
And is that a separate funding stream for the?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming up from Houston County. We really appreciate it. And unless there's any other questions, members, meeting is adjourned.